And welcome back to week three of Four Quarters, Four Questions. Once again, I'm joined by the Argyle Master himself, Mr. Adam Collier. Adam, how are you?
What's up, everybody? How you doing?
So before we get into the event today, we've got just a little bit of a tease for everybody. If you can figure out the clue that joins the lead-in and lead-out music, you're already one step ahead of some major changes coming to not just Black Shoe Diaries, but the rest of the SB Nation platform. It's going to be coming soon. We are already expecting a meltdown, so get your flaming bus picks ready.
There will definitely be no meta conversations about this whatsoever within the next week.
I can't wait to see 9 fan posts on it complaining about how things are and other ones talking about how awesome other stuff is. So yeah. I'm looking forward to you guys. Don't let me down. All right, let's get right into it. So obviously the Bill O'Brien era got its first victory this past week with a win over Navy. The team looked good in all facets, except for one missed extra point. Even the kicking was all right. So Adam, give me your first impressions about how you felt about the game.
Well, I, admittedly, in full disclosure, I didn't get to watch most of the game live. I saw bits and pieces of the second quarter in between a wedding ceremony and reception. So I actually got to watch the game on Sunday, which may have been good because I got the chance to pause it and rewind it and kind of digest the whole game. I thought the team played really well. In our preview last week, in the written preview, since you were out in State College, doing God only knows what.
As an aside, I mean, these kids, I swear you guys are just living the dream. I forget how cool it was to be in college. I was there from Monday to Thursday, and I saw probably 85% flip-flops, 45% tank tops. I can only imagine half of you were taking naps on a Tuesday afternoon, and I just want to say how much I miss that.
You know, if you get into oil and gas law, I hear you can do that too.
Well, yeah, but you have to hide under your desk. It's a little more difficult than lying on your couch.
Very Costanza-esque, I guess, huh?
Yep.
Very nice. In our written preview last week, I mentioned that I thought the defense, which traditionally struggles with these option offenses, although admittedly, the option that Navy runs is quite different from the option that Illinois has run in the past or that Northwestern runs continuously. But even so, you know, the option offense features a lot of misdirection and sort of confusing plays. It requires a defense to be super disciplined, which I think, as we've seen over the last couple weeks, this Ted Roof defense statistically has been very good for the most part, with exception to your third downs in the second half. But they've been pretty good on points scored and things of that nature. The question is, you know, were they disciplined enough to play the kind of assignment football that was necessary to get the job done? What I assumed was that they would struggle in the first quarter, maybe even the first half, to try and gain their footing, and that really didn't seem to be the case. They really, you know, they took Navy to task. They shut them down. Navy's quarterbacks, all three of them that ended up playing in this game, are far more accomplished passers than what they normally have, but the Navy team as a whole appears to be down. It's very young by comparison to the last several years.
Did you you actually expected them to come out flat at the beginning? Because that was their MO for the first two games was kind of, they came out maybe not high-powered, but they at least looked competent in the first half, and then it was kind of, you know, the second half mirrored the second half of any Pirates season in the last few years, where it's just a tanking of sorts.
Well, what I expected was that the offense would come out firing, which is what they've done the last two games. You know, the offense has looked very good in certain respects, certainly in terms of chewing up yardage before screwing up and turning over the football randomly at the end of a long workmanlike drive. But I expected the defense to be, if not flat, then at least over-pursuing, out of position, giving up chunks of yardage on the ground. I mean, I think we saw, think about the 2010 defense that we saw, that we put on the field here. Think about the team, think about the game where we played Illinois, where the ends would crash down, but they couldn't get anywhere, and the linebackers were just too slow to get from sideline to sideline, and were out of position, and then they'd cheat and over-pursue, and Illinois would get in chunks of yards on the ground and really be able to move. the ball. That's kind of what I was expecting for the first quarter. It turns out that that wasn't the case at all, and they played very, very well. I was really very pleased.
Right, and then it turns out that they could actually put an entire game together, and it was fun to watch because you saw Allen Robinson absolutely light up the scoreboard, and even in a down productive day, only five catches, he was still managed to pretty much win over anybody that was still a doubter of this passing attack, at least from a receiver's standpoint.
When was the last time that you called a Penn State receiver catching five balls a low productivity day?
Probably 94, if there was ever a time.
I mean, maybe.
That was the last time we had a high-powered offense that was able to put up the numbers that they are. Although I will say that Matt McGloin seems to have not zeroed in on Robinson as a first read. I mean, he's definitely going through his progressions, but he definitely has a favorite receiver, and that's both good and bad. He's gelling with Robinson. He's got a good rapport with him, but at some point, like many of the commenters have noted, it might burn him because with the talented secondaries that you're going to start facing in the Big Ten, they're going to start figuring out that Allen Robinson is someone you want to double cover.
Yeah, I fully expect him to force a bunch of passes into the Robinson's hands over the course of the year. Robinson's kind of taken on the Derek Moy portion of the Matt McGloin psyche, in that he's his safety blanket, and if he needs him, he'll just toss it over to him. The difference is, I think, you know, we heard O'Brien talk a little bit, at least I watched the post-game press conference, and he was talking about the need to take some more shots down the field, and how he felt pretty comfortable with the way the offense was going, but that they need to make more plays, and they hadn't taken those shots, which makes me wonder, did you see, I forget where it was, but did you see the play progression where McGloin makes the safe pass and gets 10 yards but has a man wide open down on the left side of the field?
I'm surprised that happened. I can't remember that play off the top of my head, but that it happened is surprising, although he seems to have learned his ways.
It happened in the Ohio game, and it seems pretty clear that the guy who's wide open downfield is his last read. The entire play is going to the right. And McGloin, I think, even in that play, and I may be wrong because I don't remember seeing the video necessarily, but McGloin, I believe, has play-actioned and then bootlegged out to the right following him, but stands and is sitting in the pocket, you know, by the time he gets out there. So he's not throwing on the run. He's throwing off, you know, on his toes, but standing at a full stop where he can get a full motion in.
Right.
And I guess the theory is that if he had just looked left, that we would have had a 40-yard touchdown instead of the 10-yard first down that he made. And what I think seems to have happened is, you know, O'Brien is a pretty good offensive coach. I think we can see that so far. And he knows that, you know, he wants his players to make the right play. And the right play is the safe play that gets you yards. But the problem with that is this offense is not run by Tom Brady. And this offense is not run by the New England Patriots. So expecting them to put together six or seven workmanlike drives that end in touchdowns or field goals, certainly given the special teams disasters recently, certainly not field goals, but expecting them to put together multiple drives, a half, where they're going to march down the field over 13 plays and score, is a lot to ask. And so if that's the case, they need to take a couple shots downfield, first of all, to keep the defense honest so that they can establish some type of running game, which they've had some difficulty doing. But second of all, to make sure that we can actually score some points, because this is a team that's capable of making big plays. Robinson is fast. He's a good receiver. I'm a little concerned about his hands, although less so now. But, you know, Kenny can move. Williams looked pretty decent this week. Even Mosby Felder got in the action. I mean, we have tight ends. Kyle Carter is a monster.
Right.
You know, we have guys that can make plays down the field. And McGloin, I guess I'm going to argue about this to the death with people, but McGloin has, if nothing else, he has shown a penchant for making plays down the field. He screws up a lot. He has in the past screwed up a lot of plays down the field, but he makes plays down the field. And when he does that, we're capable of scoring points and playing with anybody.
Yeah, I agree. And he's got the weapons to do it underneath if he has to. Eight receivers caught balls on Saturday, and only three of them were actual wide receivers. There were four tight ends that caught a ball, and Mike Zordich had two catches. So, you know, he's got the ability, he's got the guys to make the plays. He doesn't need to go for the long ball anymore. Run the Bill O'Brien offense, which is the flat, the underneath, the crossing, the flares. Get your 10-yard first downs as opposed to your 40-yard touchdown or your interception.
I'll tell you somebody I was really surprised with, pleasantly surprised with, and that's Zordich. I've been guilty of kind of pigeonholing him as a guy that doesn't have a lot of lateral movement, a guy that's sort of a straight line runner, and that's certainly what he is and has demonstrated previously. Mm-hmm. He showed a little bit of wiggle the other day. I mean, look, he's a big dude, right? He's not going to shake and bake anybody, right. But he can certainly, you know, he always gets extra yards. He always barrels over defenders. And I don't know, you just got to like that. There was something about him that was really attractive as a runner that I wasn't expecting at all.
And right. The ladies love him. So, I mean, how can you not root for this guy?
It's funny because there's a picture of Maudie and Zordich, and I keep looking at those two, and all I think about is, you ever see the Mighty Ducks movies?
Of course.
All I think about are the Bash Brothers.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I see when I see Maudie and Zordich, particularly when they're interviewed, because I don't know if you've noticed, but they look basically identical, and they wear identical face paint.
They're handsome guys. I mean, I wouldn't be upset if my daughter brought one of them home. Because, well, they play Penn State linebacker or fullback, so that's already points in her book. So
there you go. I was very pleased generally with the running game. I thought Dukes looked really good. He's another guy who, not the greatest pass protector, I think we can all say, but he's always getting extra yards.
Mm-hmm.
And even when there's not a hole there, he's still getting extra yards just by virtue of the fact that he's a monster and runs really fast. And, I'd actually prefer to see these guys in this offense than Bill Belton run the ball. Truthfully, I think Belton can be good. I think Day is capable, although not nearly as good as Belton. But Duke and Zordich bring a sort of power element to a finesse offense that I think really complements it very well. And I'd like to see that happen more in the future.
Right. You still need a Belton-type player in there for certain situations. Provided he can learn to bring that ball in a little bit and carry it down the field a little bit more finessely, if you will, not carrying up like a big loaf of bread on the top of his shoulder or something.
Yeah. What do you think of Paul Jones?
Well, he got his catch, so he's officially a member of the Penn State football team now in the books. He's played as many snaps as Rudy has now, so. I don't know how many snaps he played, but it was from what it looked like he did all right. He said he's feeling good. He's in a good spot. So you got to trust the coaches on that one.
Yeah, I'm rooting for the kid. I hope he does well this year. You know, they still have him, and I guess we'll talk about this in the next segment really briefly. But they still have him at third string quarterback, which is good for him. But I hope he finds a place to contribute.
Right, and he will. He definitely will.
And so, speaking of Paul Jones and the next segment, what we've seen, I guess the question for you, Jeff, is how much improvement have we seen from game to game this year? What have we seen specifically, and what should we hope to see in the future?
Well, like I was saying earlier in the podcast, the first half to me has been the same throughout. They've come out, they've looked okay to good. They've completed passes. Running holes have been there at times. They've managed the game. They just couldn't seem to put it all together. And then this first half, and they came out and put 30 on the board, or 20 on the board, and it was, you know, you were like, okay, well, it's 20-0, but, you know, you were thinking in the back of your mind about Ohio and Virginia and what was going to happen in the second half. But early on in the game, one of the commenters, and I forget who, I don't know if it was that hobbit of a man, Mike Patrick, in the booth, or his partner, that said that the team looked looser, the team was relaxed, the team was kind of bouncing around, having fun, and they just looked that way. They were enjoying themselves. I don't know what changed. Other than Paul Jones moving to tight end, I don't think there were any major news out of Penn State, Shawnee Kersee leaving, but I don't know how that one player could change the game.
I'm sure, according to ESPN, that he's the most important player on our roster.
Right, and he left and he transferred, and it was the biggest transfer ever in the history, just like when they continue to name Tim Buckley as one of the transfers, which I don't know why that's continued to be named, but for whatever reason, they want to hone in on this walk-on defensive back who, to my knowledge, did not have a scholarship, but because he left NC State, that's a big deal.
I don't even know. I feel bad about this, and I'm not trying to be rude. I legitimately don't even know who he is.
Yeah, you and 98% of the Penn State watching population, because unless your last name is Buckley, or unless you follow it as closely as some people study the depth charts and the roster religiously, I don't think that the vast, vast majority of people do, until ESPN picked up on the story and said, oh, Tim Buckley's transferring.
I mean, I wish him the best, and I hope he does really well. Honestly, walk-on kid, wanted to go home, good for him. Made the team here. I just don't know who he is, and so I don't understand why that's a big deal. But in either case, I guess it doesn't matter.
Right, that's neither here nor there. The players have stayed, and they're playing well, and this game showed that. Granted, at times they showed flashes of regression, and there were mistakes, but the mistakes were limited, and the offense seemed to just click and gel. They had over 100 yards on the ground. McGloin was a steady quarterback that didn't throw any interceptions, 4 touchdowns. I mean, it was a change of pace in that they seemed to put an entire game together. So as for improvements, I would say, yeah, we saw improvement between weeks 1 and 2 and now the 3rd week.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with the improvement shown overall. I think O'Brien's starting to get his sea legs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's starting to really feel like a head coach now. And I think that shows. I think he's more confident. The one place we haven't shown much improvement is on special teams.
Right, but that's not really his fault so much. I mean, he brought in a special teams coach, sort of, and they only have to work with what they have to work with. And the loss of Anthony Farrah is arguably the biggest loss, although you can argue that his injury was going to keep him out this season anyway. So I'm not sure how much his sticking around would have changed things, but this just goes to show you how much a kicker can make or break a team, because you could definitely argue that he would have won the Virginia game, although some other plays may have won it as well. So that's why I kind of was half joking whenever I said it on Twitter that we should give 2 scholarships to the best kicker in the country next year. Just because it's a very important position, and that's kind of the one area where we still need to see improvement. The other offense and defense, I've seen some solid improvement.
Yeah, I've been really satisfied. I think the running game particularly improved from game 2 to 3, and even from game 1 to 2 to 3. Despite the loss of what was theoretically our top running back, even though he was a converted wide receiver, that's a part of the offense that I would like to see do a little bit more, even from now. And I was happy to see that it seemed to work out in the Navy game, and it's something that I'd like to see going forward. The defense, I thought, has played fairly well, generally, with some lapses on third down, actually almost always lapses on third down in the second half. I actually didn't see what the statistics was like against Navy, so I guess I don't necessarily know if that ended up better or worse, but I'm hopeful that it ended up better. What I'd really like to see improvement on from here on out is, so our defensive backs can run with anybody. Truly. Morris is always step for step with the receiver. He never appears to look back at the ball. Ever. And consequently, he never makes a play on the ball. So what we have is a situation where receivers are running down the field in single coverage, and the ball is thrown, and if Morris literally just turned around and put his hand in the air, the ball would have been deflected or intercepted or anything else. But instead, occasionally, it turns into a 30-yard gain, and that's pretty scary. Although I don't think we'll see any really tremendous quarterbacks in the Big Ten from here on out. But that's the kind of thing that can really kill you, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And, yeah, like you said, they can run with people, but it's the execution down the line that counts. And, you know, I'm surprised. I expected with this Ted Roof multiple, whatever you want to call it, I expected to see a lot more of the bump and run. But I'm just not sure that he has the athletes in place to do it. He's got Adrian Amos, who is going to be a very good defensive back, but you can't play one person bump and run and the rest of them in a soft cover three. It's just they have to play all or nothing, and I think Ted Roof learned his lesson early on after getting burnt a couple of times by Tettleton and Rocco and what's the guy's name that came from Alabama?
Phil Sims.
Getting burned by them, he learned his lesson to kind of come back and play more of a Bradley-esque defense, and that kind of probably pleased a few of the Penn State nostalgia fans, but it's he's pretty much playing to his strengths. So yeah, that defense now is going to rely even more heavily on the front seven, which, you know, they're looking good. How many NFL players do you see on that front seven? I mean, there's at least five or six that will eventually get a shot, if not see serious time in the NFL.
Both tackles, both starting tackles are NFL players.
I don't think I'll get much disagreement when I say that Daquan Jones is a better tackle than Jordan Hill.
I don't know. I mean, I think they're both excellent.
They are. They're both good, but Daquan Jones has just been – he's a true junior. I mean, he's shown that, especially in a Larry Johnson defensive line, if you come in and contribute right away and work your way up like that, you've got some serious talent.
Yeah.
And he's just shown that he's a monster up front.
Don't you see a guy like Hodges as just a perfect fit for some super aggressive scheme in the NFL? Like, doesn't he kind of look like the kind of linebacker, him and Marty both, that would really fit in a Rex Ryan-type defense or San Francisco's defense or something along those lines?
It's always moving, always kind of disguising stuff. They can line up on the line if they had to. They could drop into coverage. I mean, Hodges started out as a safety. You know, he's going to have some serious range at the next level. Hopefully he can head to Pittsburgh, but, you know, that's a wish. But, yeah, like you said, him and Maudie are guys that are just going to fly around the field. Maudie's problem is going to be his injury concerns.
Yeah.
So that's going to make his draft stock drop a bit.
I think that's true, but at the same time, you know, he's talented enough where the NFL will find a place for him.
Oh, absolutely. He'll get a shot. But he's not going to be a top five pick that a Penn State linebacker like him would have been had he not blown out five knees.
Yeah, and that's the shame. I mean, I think, you know, maybe Sean Lee is a good sort of doppelganger for him in the NFL.
And
maybe
that's not too bad. I mean, Lee is blowing stuff up.
He's
in Dallas.
The kind of guy that just succeeds in like a defensive coordinator's dream defense. You know, we had a guy. So I'm a Jet fan, which I think most people know. We had a guy who played at Wisconsin, who you'll remember, Jim Leonard, for several years, who was undersized at safety, but was incredibly quick and was just so smart, you know? And that's what I see in Maudie. I just feel like he's such a smart player. Hodges, too. They seem to know where they're supposed to be at all times. And they're extremely athletic. I mean, Hodges, because of the, you know, he less injury concerns than Maudie, you know, is probably a little bit more athletic at this point. But these guys are just so smart and so capable, and they're really just going to do great things in the NFL, I think.
I sure hope so.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to one of them coming to Pittsburgh. I can definitely, we could definitely use the depth right now. That's where the Steelers are struggling a bit.
I hear you. All right, my friend, I believe that sound signifies halftime, so.
I think it does, too. All right, so I was thinking about this the other day, and a recent meme on Black Shoe Diaries has been this whole Emma Stone, Blake Lively debate, and I don't think we'll ever get an answer between the two parties. Neither side was ever going to agree, and I believe you and I disagree, because I believe you're Team Blake.
There's an answer, and it's Blake Lively, sorry.
That's why you're wrong.
I'm not going to concede.
But I'm going to give you a new one.
Okay.
So I'm going to throw this out there, and it's kind of a different direction, although it's still in the same cute girl genre.
Okay.
Just because I was watching one of these actresses' movies recently, and it got me thinking. So okay. I'm going to give this to you real quick. Amy Adams.
Okay.
Isla Fisher.
Amy Adams.
Two girls next door, both incredibly sexy. And you're going right for Amy Adams, right off the bat.
Yeah. Amy Adams, and it's not even close for me.
What are you thinking of when you think of it? Is it Ricky Bobby? Is it Talladega Nights? Is it Julie and Julia? Is it Sunshine Cleaners?
What else was she in?
I don't know. That's all I can think of off the top of my head.
She was also in, I'm going to really embarrass myself.
Enchanted.
She was in the Disney movie. Right?
I don't know.
Wasn't she in Enchanted?
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Oh, I didn't hear you say Enchanted.
Yeah, so now we're both nerds, all right?
Yeah, Amy Adams in Enchanted.
But something about Isla Fisher in Definitely Maybe. And even the crazy parts of her in Wedding Crashers.
I actually didn't see Definitely Maybe.
Oh my God.
So you've got me beat.
I actually minored in romantic comedies, and Definitely Maybe is probably the best one in the past 5-6 years.
That's a bold statement.
That is a very bold statement. I'm never going to go with that's the best one ever, but in the last few years, I haven't seen too many that they could rival it.
All right. Fair enough. I only think about her in Wedding Crashers. I guess I didn't see. She was in another fairly large movie that I'm sure she was. Confessions of a Shopaholic, maybe? Is that her?
Yeah, I remember seeing previews for that. I certainly did not see that movie.
No, I didn't see it either. But so I think all I think about her in is Wedding Crashers. And problem.
Sometimes that particular breed of crazy is somewhat attractive.
To, the perfect woman in Rachel McAdams. So,
Oh, that seems like a debate for another time. All right, well, on the back of that rather lighthearted discussion, let's move into some more dark discussion, and let's cover some of it topics. A couple quick things that we can cover. One, news out of the Associated Press today was that a task force has been named to oversee the $60 million that Penn State has had to pay. And according to the AP, the 10-member task force is going to include members from Penn State, so we'll have some representation, other NCAA member schools, and then Health and Human Services representative, as well as the United Way Worldwide CEO, Brian Gallagher. So it's good to see that they're trying to staff this task force with charitable and what should hopefully be reputable personnel. But what do you think about this $60 million fine? Where should it go? Where do you think it'll go? How do you even feel about it to begin with?
This is a total nightmare on multiple levels. Reading it makes me want to smack somebody. Frankly, trusting the NCAA to distribute anything equitably is insane. So administrators from Penn State will be a part of it, and then other member schools, which are never specified, nonprofit executives, representatives from the Department of Health and Human Services. I actually don't have any problem with government officials being a part of this. I think actually they're probably the most logical ones, frankly.
Least corrupt.
Out of everybody here. Can somebody tell me what an administrator from another member and NCAA member institution can add to this committee at all?
You know what I think? You know what I think he can add, and it's actually refreshing. I think he can add oblivion. Let me clarify what I mean by that. You can find somebody from South Dakota State University who has little to no knowledge of all this, other than there was a horrendous string of crimes at Penn State or that involved former Penn State officials. My apologies to certain readers out there. But this guy sitting somewhere in South Dakota, Montana, Idaho, New Mexico knows nothing other than we've got $60 million. We need to dole it out in terms that we see equitably fit.
And are you calling him a member of the 47%?
I don't know what that means.
I'm making a crass political comment in the middle of this podcast. I apologize.
Right. Well, I've been woefully out of the political news spectrum, thankfully, I guess.
No politics. No politics.
No politics until Monday. And then, well, politics are welcome to avoid or to kind of get us away from the rest of the meltdowns.
But no, you were saying? I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying this person could provide a kind of a voice of reason. And I don't mean that in that the rest of the people are going to be corrupt politicians and Penn Staters and people looking out for their own good. I think this person can provide, or these people, we don't even know if it's just one person or multiple people, can provide a view that people in the NCAA offices might not be aware of. They can say, you know, here's what it's like in the real world. I've been working in Santa Fe for the past 20 years as an administrative deputy, assistant, athletic director, whatever you want to call them, and know that that's all they know. They don't know who Ray Grecar is, or you know, all these other tangentially related people involved with this scandal. They only know that they have this task of doling out $60 million to appropriate channels, and what those appropriate channels are remain to be seen, though.
That's my problem. I think, you know, a 10-member task force sounds really nice, and a nonpartisan, or however they want to term it, administrator, a third-party administrator, is how the Associated Press puts it, to choose what nonprofit groups receive the money each year. I'm curious what they really need the 10-member task force for when they'll have a third-party administrator, number one. Number two, I don't think there's any indication that any of these people have any expertise in what constitutes a valid charity. And certainly, given the fact that a billion people were fooled by the Second Mile and its usefulness as a charity, my concern is that these people have no experience in what they're doing, and the money is essentially going to go to waste, at least some of it.
Yeah, but by that logic, is there anybody that would be qualified to be on this task force? If a billion people were fooled by the Second Mile, and all these people are fooled on it every day by people like Jerry Sandusky, is anybody actually qualified? Can you ever trust anybody enough to put them on a task force like this?
I suppose that's true. Although, you know, what I think should have been done with the money in the first place is not create this fund. You know, look, this isn't the stimulus bill. We're not distributing money through the Department of Transportation or somewhere else for grants for big projects, right? Or at least that shouldn't be the role of some random 10-member task force that's being selected by the NCAA. It seems to me that this money would have been better served being used to create some kind of center at Penn State jointly with the Big Ten and the NCAA as partners in creating some kind of academic center at Penn State where they do research on these issues and come up with answers. It's hard to say come up with answers, but at least come up with potential answers or responses or educational methods for this kind of thing. Look, the NCAA member institutions are in the business of educating. They're not in the business of making block grants to organizations that they don't know. And as far as I'm concerned, I just really feel like they're really out of their depth. And I don't know that they're capable of doing this large scale project on the experience that they have.
That's right. Well, yeah, I mean, they're going to come up with however they want to dole out this $60 million, and I'm not sure how much oversight there's going to be by either the NCAA, maybe the Department of Education, because they'll have an official there. Who's going to be able to veto or approve, or are they just going to have carte blanche authority to dole it out? I'm not sure. So I guess all we can do is sit back and second guess what they do. But one thing I want to talk about, and to kind of turn this conversation a little bit, is the recent article in the New Yorker by Malcolm Gladwell. And I know you've read it. I've certainly read it. It was a very well written, and I believe, and don't sue me for revealing your words, but I believe you called it horrifyingly. What was your word? Horrifyingly impressive.
Were those my words from the email that I sent the other day to everybody?
That was your quote. It was a horrifyingly impressive article, and I definitely agree, because it was something that was detached in that it was not from somebody that was a Penn Stater or had a Penn State angle, but it was somebody who was writing it as if they were taking an objective, nonpartisan look at this and were kind of coming to certain conclusions. Granted, he didn't cover everything, and that would take a lot longer of an investigation and an article by Gladwell, who I certainly appreciate as a writer, but he was the first person of the national media, and I'm not sure I would call him a sports media, although he's certainly covered sports in the past. I wouldn't say he's particularly a sports media per se, but he was the first national media person that kind of took an objective look at this and didn't come down on the side of everyone at Penn State's guilty, screw them all.
Yeah, the Gladwell article is, I actually thought it was phenomenal, frankly. First of all, as far as the topics that are covered by the Gladwell, as far as the topic that's being covered by Gladwell's article and the stories that are told in them, I mean, they're horrifying. I think that word is accurate. The story about the Canadian gym teacher or the gentleman who had befriended people at local watering holes, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
People who were having troubles at home and would babysit kids. And the story with the guy and his future wife and the child who he was babysitting, it's just horrifying.
Yeah, they were nightmare stories, but the way he writes an article, you read them and you see that they're awful stories, but you can kind of, you can see where he's going and where he's trying to frame the article, because he's trying to show you, what happens elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, look, here's the deal, and I think maybe I'm coming from a different perspective than a lot of people on this, and not necessarily Penn Staters, but when I discuss it with outside people, and I think that a lot of people look at it as, and I've seen comments, and I've certainly seen Gladwell's article posted elsewhere, and then read the comments about it, even on websites, and I'm not going to name them, but websites whose commenters I generally respect, who provide really thoughtful conversation, right? And even they say, this is BS. Obviously, they all knew about it, and they did nothing. Which shows you that even thoughtful people, even generally thoughtful people, think that this is, they just get so emotionally just angry about the entire concept. It's hard for me to even articulate it, but
yeah, it's tough to talk about if even.
Yeah, I see it from part of the reason that I understand the Gladwell article so well, and because I concede his points that a lot of people don't, is that I often see things based on my employment from an institutional perspective, and an administrative perspective. And so when he talks about the principal, right, who's approached with this story, this horrifying story, about a well-respected community member. And the story that he hears is vague and confusing and doesn't jive at all with what he understands this man to be. And he's confused and doesn't know what to do, and he talks to these parents and they're confused and they don't know what to do. And a lot of people just say, oh, well, obviously they should have known better. They were trying to, they were burying their heads in the sand because they didn't know, They wanted to bury their heads in the sand because they didn't want to assume it's true. Part of that may be accurate, but I think what you saw in the Gladwell article, at least from the perspective that I'm reading it from, is that this stuff happens so much, and these people, when they receive these kinds of discussions, understand that accusations like that can ruin people's lives if they're false. And so people tend to tread really carefully around this stuff. And the kinds of interactions that these people of Jerry Sandusky's ilk are having with the kinds of interactions that they're having with these kids in public looks like any normal father figure is having that interaction with their son, you know, holding a kid's hand or putting his arm around them or having them bounce on their knee or turning them upside down and kind of roughhousing with them. Like, these are the kinds of things that fathers do with their sons or uncles do with their nephews, anything like that. And there is a real risk, you know, when administrators receive these reports or when people receive these reports, that they don't want to ruin somebody's life over something that seems so innocent. And it's only when you look back at these kinds of stories that suddenly this behavior isn't innocent at all. You know, they mentioned in that Gladwell article that the gym teacher used to pick kids up by the ankles and hold them upside down, and the kids would giggle and everybody would laugh and it would be a great time. Like, I think we all know people that have done that, right?
Yeah.
Well, they mentioned that, you know, suddenly all of these parents become very aware that, you know, he may be doing it for ulterior motives. And that's the scariest part, is that it's not so easy to identify. And what do you do when you get this vague report about possible abuse, maybe, but it doesn't seem like it. And also, these are 10-year-old kids, so they don't really know what they're talking about either. And there's this whole big gray area, and that's where these people operate. And it's really, really scary. And I think it's the most logical, at least Gladwell presented what I think is the most logical explanation for all this behavior that happened anyway. These people, who admittedly probably should have done something different if they knew about the 1998 incident, which at least several of them did, okay? These people were so obviously fooled by Jerry Sandusky. And I don't know how you fix that. And that's the scary part for me.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I don't know. It's the whole situation makes me really sad. And, I mean, I'll be the first one to tell you that, well, you know, I mean, look, the trial was over. And obviously, I followed it. I covered it for BSE. And, I felt as though there was a real conclusion to things and that there was some resolution for the victims, and you know, we could pray for them and offer them help and all of these things, and that this chapter could be closed. And we had NCAA officials, you know, we had people with experience dealing with the NCAA telling us, oh, you know, no NCAA rules have been broken here, blah, 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 blah. And it turns out that nothing is anywhere near its conclusion. And look at the kind of effect it's had on the university, on its alumni, on its students, on people across the nation, whether you agree or disagree, whether their views are overly emotional, whether you think their views are overly emotional or not. I mean, this is the kind of story that resonates with people, and it's horrifying.
Right. It's something you have to deal with the rest of your life as an alumni.
Yeah, exactly.
Let alone, you know, a victim obviously is going to have to deal with it for the rest of his life. But this affects so many more people as well. It's just, it's something everybody that is even related to it is going to have to live with as long as they live.
Yeah. I mean, look, I wore my white Penn State windbreaker today with the blue stripe, a white windbreaker with a blue stripe down the back, just so everybody is aware. It looks kind of like a logo that I know. I wore it, and I was waiting in my office vestibule, waiting for the rain to stop in New York. And I put it on. I was talking to a bunch of people, and one of my buddies looked at me and goes, oh, you're still wearing that, huh? I mean, this is almost a year later than when the scandal broke. Oh, you're still wearing that?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I am, because I'm a Penn State alum, and I'm really proud.
Yeah, exactly, because nothing changed about who I am and where I come from. If anything, they need my support more, the victims, the other people in the university that weren't in any way involved.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's definitely something that we're going to have to live with for quite some time and be able to handle effectively.
Right. And
I hope that all of us handle it effectively, because what I think everybody has to understand is that we're not just representing ourselves when we talk about it. We're really representing the institution and the values that we hold true to ourselves and to a family. A real family atmosphere, a family of 500 and some odd thousand alumni and 40,000 students at University Park and 80,000 students statewide. You know, you're not just representing yourself when you talk about this issue. You're representing the entire university community. So I think people need to be aware of that.
All right. Well, I think on that note, there you go. Let's move on. Let's quickly get to the fourth quarter, just because we're running a little late on time here, so let's cover these new Big East Temple Owls and see what we got coming into town on Saturday at 3:30, ABC, ESPN2, depending on your regional coverage. I know mine started on ESPN2 last week because of the Ohio State game. But what do the Owls look like? What are they bringing in? What can we see? I know Bernard Pierce is gone. And what's his face is now the head coach, much to the chagrin of people like Spencer Hall and the rest of the Florida Gator faithful.
It's a really good question, I think, that I don't know the answer to. I know that Bernard Pierce is gone, and I know that Kevin Newsom is there. I can tell you that they are. I'm looking at the ESPN overall FBS rankings, and they are 60th in points against, 44th in points for. They seem, you know, that they won in week one, and then a Maryland team who really didn't look very good against some FCS competition beat them last week 36-27. I don't know. I'm kind of just hoping for Kevin Newsom's sighting. What do you think?
What it gives me kind of some optimism is that they're 122nd. To be honest, I didn't even know that there were 122 schools in FBS. I thought there were only 120. So they are pretty bad in passing. So whatever Kevin Newsom's doing down there, if he's doing anything, because I thought it was just is it Chris or Christian or Curtis Coyer, whatever his name is I thought that was their main quarterback. So if Kevin Newsom brought anything to the passing game, it wasn't much.
Yeah, Chris Coyer, I remember the name at least, and I'm looking at his stats right now. 12 of 29 for 239 yards. They look like Rob Bolton numbers.
Yeah, 29 attempts over two games. That's, I think, I did that in sixth grade Pee Wee football.
That's a bold statement right there.
Even that was probably too high.
I imagine it is, yeah. I admittedly, I don't know that much about Temple. I think that they're down from the last couple of years, although still a dangerous team generally, particularly for us, because we all know that we're their biggest game of the year. We're the biggest game on their schedule.
Right.
And I think that's something to be concerned with.
And they do play in a rough part of Philadelphia, or they go to school in a rough part of Philadelphia, so you kind of have to watch out.
You didn't happen to go to the Temple game last year, did you?
I did not.
Running into some Temple fans last year was really unpleasant. Suddenly, it's as if they believe that they're the greatest team in the entire world. Which, given the fact that their Temple is laughable, except that they were really vulgar and just kind of unnecessarily rude to all the fans that I've seen, that I saw it in Philadelphia. It was pretty disappointing, so I'm hoping we kind of lay it down on them, frankly.
Good, good. Take out some aggression.
Yeah. What do you expect us to do?
Coming off of that game against Navy, I think they're going to come out and do the exact same thing. I think they're going to keep the momentum going. Bill O'Brien is not going to come out and try to score 63 points against a UMass team like Brady Hoke did. He doesn't have a Denard Robinson under center, so That's not going to happen. They're going to run the game that they know how to run. They're going to try to get themselves right the ship a little bit, get to 2-2 heading into Big Ten play, get the momentum moving in the right direction where they could still have a chance to win the division, take home that fake trophy, and you know, at the very least, they can cause some problems in the Big Ten if they can't compete for the Big Ten title. The very least they can do is spoil some other dreams. But as for Saturday, I think it's going to be a lot of the same as you saw this past Saturday. Every now and then there'll be a bomb, and as soon as McGloin, you know, you can see it 3 steps before he does it, and as soon as he starts that wind up, that little bit extra long wind up that he has, I cringe. Because I know he's probably got a third or fourth read underneath, but that's going to be the play. Is every now and then a bomb, steady gameplay. Let's throw him out now, and I'll say 31-7.
Okay, all right. Here's what I think is going to happen. Generally, I think Temple definitely has a decent running back this year. He was their backup last year and the year before. This kid, Matt Brown, who was Bernard Pierce's backup, who was completely capable when Pierce went out of the game. I don't remember if that was last year or the 2010 season. In either case, Brown can play. Here's the deal. Brown is 5'5 and 165 pounds. What I think is going to happen is that Roof is just going to send the house on almost every play. And he's going to be super aggressive until Coyer can prove that he can actually pass the ball with any sort of consistency whatsoever.
Right, and that might give some optimism, if you will, to the defensive secondary. Maybe they can kind of get some, hey, I can play with some guys, feeling behind them. This is a Big East team, although it's, you know, a brand new Big East team, and it's still the Big East. So
that's exactly right.
It's still just Temple.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think that you're going to see him leaving his secondary out on a bit of an island this week, but that's probably okay because what he probably should be doing is trying to stop the run, making sure the season numbers that I'm looking at right now is that he's averaging 6.1 yards a carry. Last year he averaged 5.9 yards a carry, so it's not too much different. He's a really capable runner. He's a very good player. But he's small, and I'm fairly certain that Gerald Hodges can eat him. So
and likely will.
So I think you're going to see some. I think you're going to see us put Stack 8 in the box and try and force him to pass, and you know we'll see what they can do from there. Adazio is apparently he's one of O'Brien called him one of his best friends in coaching, which I think is funny because it sounds to me like everybody is Bill O'Brien's best friend in coaching.
Yeah, if he was his best friend in coaching, he would have been named defensive coordinator last year.
Yeah, even though he's an offensive coach, that would have been really interesting. That's very Philadelphia Eagles-like.
Hey, we don't have much of a defensive coordinator as it is, so it wouldn't have surprised me.
Well, listen, we can take Doug Marone, I guess, when he gets fired from Syracuse at some point, but who's also Bill O'Brien's best friend in coaching.
One can only hope.
Look, I don't think this team is as good as they were during the Al Golden years, several years that he was there. I don't think they're as dangerous as they were last year, and what I'd like to see is a Penn State team come in and, you know, from bell to bell, just beat the hell out of somebody. So I'm thinking it probably won't be as pretty as last week was, but something like 27-13.
All right. And on that note, we'll close up shop. And as you listen to the song on the way out, see if you can think of the theme that ties the lead in, the lead out songs together. That will give you a little bit of a hint as to what's coming next week. Hopefully you guys can figure it out, but I have a sneaking suspicion you won't because it's pretty close to the vest. So unless you know somebody that knows somebody, you're going to be in the dark, and you're just going to explode with some vitriol on Monday. So we'll see you all then. Adam, until next week, go Penn State.
Always a good time.